Here and Now is a production of WBUR Boston in association with the BBC World Service and PRI.
I'm Robin Young. It's Here and Now.
We're going to have to continue to work with our partners to prevent future attacks. We have to continue to be prepared to confront them when they arise. And we have to ensure that those who commit acts of piracy are held accountable for their crimes.
President Obama speaking today. Well, the pirates are speaking as well. Jamak Habib, a 30-year-old Somali pirate, says from now on, if we capture foreign ships and their countries attack us, we will kill the hostages. That threat came after U.S. Navy snipers killed three Somali pirates and freed U.S. cargo ship Captain Richard Phillips yesterday. And while there is joy that Phillips is safe, there are questions. What will happen to the 200-plus hostages from around the world aboard captured ships off the coast of Somalia? Well, let's start with quick look at today's top news story. Journalist John Burnett is with us. He was once held hostage himself by pirates in the South China Sea. John, do you think the existing hostages are in more danger now?
Oh, I don't think there's any doubt. But it's important to point out, Robin, that piracy in these waters is an act in which the pirates can get millions of dollars in return for the hostages. So I believe that there's going to be some event in which a hostage is either injured or paraded in front of a television camera and perhaps even killed. But generally speaking, the more than 250 hostages there, I think while they are in harm's way, I don't think anything serious is going to happen to them.
Well, Shane Murphy, the second in command on the Maersk Alabama, the U.S. cargo ship, made a plea today to President Obama to use all resources to end the scourge of Somali piracy, as he said. He said it's a crisis, wake up. But Bloomberg News is reporting that the U.S. military is considering attacks on pirate bases and already has a task force. This is Task Force 151 that since January has been using helicopters and Marine Corps snipers to thwart piracy. So your thoughts on how much more involved the U.S. might get?
Well, to go in there would risk the lives of the men and women who are now staring down the barrels of loaded guns and being held hostage, and also the collateral damage would be severe. And also it must be kept in mind that we don't have the intelligence to know exactly who pirates are and who they are not. A fisherman could be a pirate for 1 minute and then a legitimate fisherman the next.
Well, in our reading, this could go two ways. Thomas Jefferson attacked the Barbary pirates, eventually succeeded, but that was a diplomatic as well as a military effort. And then there was the Somalia intervention in 1993. In modern history, that, of course, was disastrous.
Well, going back to Thomas Jefferson and the Barbary pirates, he originally negotiated with the head of the Barbary pirates for to make sure that the piracy ceased and desisted in the Mediterranean. So I think it's important to realize that first we have to figure out a more peaceful way of going in. The military option should always be on the table, and when you talk about getting allies to help us, you know, we have the largest armada, the most powerful armada of military warships, naval assets, ever assembled in recent years to try to stop piracy, and piracy is still a crime that's out of control.
Well, we've talked about this before. I mean, we come sort of full circle to the same conclusion. To fix this problem, wouldn't the U.S. or the world's leaders have to fix Somalia?
Well, that's the key. That's the key. Piracy was controlled in Southeast Asia in the Malacca Straits when the littoral states, Singapore, Indonesia, and Malaysia got together, pooled their resources, and made a determined effort to stop piracy. You don't have a government in Somalia, unfortunately. It has been a state of anarchy since 1991. So without a government to control its population, pirates can run rampant throughout the seas. And it's a very lucrative profession. It's Somalia's fastest-growing industry. And a lot of the pirates are ex-fishermen, and it's a lot more lucrative than pulling up half-empty fishing nets.
Well, Bloomberg News, in addition to reporting that the U.S. military is considering attacks on pirate bases, is also reporting that the U.S. is considering, you know, mobilizing even more aid effort to the people of Somalia. But just a last quick question to you. There is an al-Qaeda-linked terrorist group in Somalia, but is there a connection between the pirates and that group, or are these just criminals in a lawless society and even less nefarious, people out of work who can, as you say, go from fisherman to pirate in the blink of an eye?
Yeah, good question. At this point, there is no evidence that there is a direct link between the pirates and the al-Shabaab, which is the al-Qaeda-linked terrorist group. Normally, a Somali may make as much as, if they're lucky, $50 a month for whatever job he performs. When you get to be a pirate, you make hundreds of thousands. And so it's this time last year, or actually 18 months ago, there were 150 to 200 pirates along the Somali coast. Today, there are estimated 2,000 pirates, and the waiting list of job applicants is quite long.
That's John Burnett, journalist and author of Dangerous Waters, Modern Piracy and Terror on the High Seas. He was himself a hostage at one point. John Burnett, thanks so much.
Okay, thank you, Robin.
Well, President Obama approved yesterday's sniper attack on the pirates. Let's just think about that for a second. Three sharpshooters on rolling seas aiming at three pirates at night. One pirate holding an AK-47 to the American hostage's back. It could have gone terribly wrong, but it didn't. And that small military operation off the coast of Somalia is being scored as an early military victory for the president. As today's Washington Post puts it, victory, no matter how small, is better than failure. And it comes as Obama enters this, the 84th day of his administration. So how is the president's 100-day report card looking so far? Let's ask Jonathan Alter. He's, of course, the columnist for Newsweek, who also wrote the book that was on President Obama's nightstand as he prepared to take office back in January. The book is called The Defining Moment, FDR's 100 Days and the Triumph of Hope. Jonathan, in Boston today for a program on President Obama's first 100 days at the Kennedy Library. And so we're grateful you had time to join us in the studio. Jonathan, welcome.
Thanks, Robin.
And let's just talk about the piracy story. As we said, great joy in Vermont and everywhere. Captain Phillips is coming home. But is the rescue overblown in that Barack Obama's backers are saying this proves that even though he has somewhat muted response. We didn't see him on television much over the weekend. He can get the job done militarily.
Well, I mean, this was good fortune, and that the Navy SEALs were well trained and executed their mission. So it's better to be lucky than be smart sometimes. This worked out well for the president, although I'm not sure that we've heard the end of it, because sometimes what happens is a small story like piracy. Remember, so we just heard, we've had ships being seized and hostages taken for quite a while now. A small story can suddenly become a large story, which is what's now happened. Mm. So it may be that, as the pirates themselves indicated, they will test the American government and the American president again. And I think the administration would like to de-emphasize this so that you don't have what's called asymmetrical warfare between a small group of pirates and the mighty United States government.
The Navy was reportedly in negotiations with Somali elders before last night's attack, and reportedly the Navy wanted to arrest the pirates. The elders wanted to punish them themselves, and that was sort of the standoff. And then the Navy said they were forced to shoot the pirates when they say a pirate pointed a gun at Richard Phillips. The pirates today are saying, you know, the Navy killed our teenagers. They broke the peace process. We were in negotiations.
That's ridiculous.
I know. Yeah. But in other words, it just goes to perhaps this can still go bad for Barack Obama.
Yeah. I mean, I think, you know, we've got to remember that this is a nasty neighborhood. At the beginning of Bill Clinton's term in office, you may remember that an American soldier's body was dragged through the streets of Mogadishu.
Of course.
Became, you know, the movie Black Hawk Down.
And the real life event, yeah.
And the wonderful nonfiction book by Mark Bowden, on which it was based, gives some sense of the level of disorder in that country. Since 1991, they haven't had a functioning government there. And remember, the coastline in Somalia is practically as long as the east coast of the United States. And you have just a tremendous amount of disorder and dysfunction there in a failed state. So when you get that kind of situation, the line between piracy and terrorism, or between using, you know, a failed state as a staging ground for piracy and using it as a staging ground just to bloody the nose of the United States, which is equivalent of a terrorist act, that line becomes pretty thin.
That these, as we're just hearing from John Burnett and others, that these criminals, these, you know, sort of lawless, a lot of them teenagers out of work, could slide over the line to full terrorism. Interesting you mentioned that, Jonathan Alter. I want to move on to other things, but you'll notice that I don't think the Obama administration ever used the word terrorist to talk about the pirates.
No, because they weren't classic terrorists.
That hasn't stopped other people.
But no, they were after money, which is a different motive than terrorists usually have. But pretty soon it becomes a distinction without a difference.
Right. Okay, well, let's take a look at the rest of the report card. It is day 84, but, you know, everybody's thinking we're inching towards the 100 days. What are your thoughts so far about the Obama administration?
Well, he's made some mistakes, but I think overall he stacks up very, very well at this point, historically speaking, with other presidents. And, in fact, he's now almost in the league of Lyndon Johnson in 1965 and Franklin Roosevelt in 1933.
Why?
He's far exceeded all other presidents in the time since then in terms of what he's accomplished in his first 100 days. He's just put a lot of points on the board, and it seems like he's signing a new bill practically every week. So the next one up will be a dramatic expansion of national service from 75,000 to 250,000. This is a big deal for those of us who are interested in the national service movement. So he'll be signing that bill.
This is AmeriCorps?
In a few days. AmeriCorps. Mm-hmm. Yeah. And there's been so much activity, so many executive orders, so many bills passed that it's almost hard to keep track of. I'm trying to track it for my next book on Obama's first year. But if you look at something like the stimulus package, close to $800 billion, really that was about six or seven or maybe even 10 major pieces of legislation in one. It was the largest tax cut in American history. It was the largest investment in infrastructure since the establishment of the interstate highway system in the 1950s. It was the biggest anti-poverty program in more than a generation. It was the biggest federal funding of education in history, the biggest increase in that area. So you're talking about just a tremendous series of changes in a very short period of time.
Which is exactly what, in a parallel reality from yours, you know, his critics hold up as criticism of Barack Obama. I want to point to Michael Gerson, former speechwriter for George W. Bush, so perhaps a partisan. But he says that Barack Obama is, in fact, the most divisive president, more so than Ronald Reagan or George W. Bush. He points to some Pew Research Center numbers about partisan gaps that for George Bush, a few months into his first term, the partisan gap was about 51 percentage points, you know, between Republican and Democratic approval ratings. For Obama, the partisan gap is at 61 points. In other words, the difference between how Republicans and Democrats view him. And Michael Gerson says it's just because of the huge amount of dollars in all of these bills that you just mentioned that are being, you know, put out by the Obama administration. So when I ask you that, Jonathan Alter, about, you know, the downside of all these bills that have been coming out of the Obama administration, that's Newsweek's Jonathan Alter talking about Barack Obama's first 100 days. And, of course, he wrote the book, The Defining Moment, FDR's 100 Days and the Triumph of Hope. And we'll get a comparison when we come back. That's just in 1 minute here and now.
Funding for Here and Now comes from the MathWorks, creators of MATLAB and Simulink technical computing software, dedicated to accelerating the pace of discovery in engineering and science worldwide, on the web at mathworks.com.
Welcome back to Here and Now. Also today, we're going to check in on Postville, Iowa, a year after one of the largest federal immigration raids took place there. But meanwhile, we're continuing our conversation with Jonathan Alter from Newsweek about Barack Obama's first 100 days. And Jonathan, you were saying that you just can't keep up with the flurry of activity from the Obama administration, all that he's accomplished, casting it in sort of a positive light. And as we were saying, his critics don't. They say he's taking on too much right now. The plans are too ambitious. And Republicans in particular are worried. You know, your thoughts about that?
Well, it's hardly surprising. I mean, before the break, you mentioned that Michael Gerson, George W. Bush's speechwriter, said he was the most partisan president in recent times, and he compared him to Bush at the beginning of Bush's term. But remember, it wasn't until after 9/11 when President Bush decided to politicize 9/11, use it as a cudgel, as a weapon in the 2002 midterm elections, that we got the huge partisan split in this country when he was president, which dwarfed anything that we have today. So it's just not factually accurate unless you make an apples and oranges comparison to say that Obama is more divisive. And Obama was also doing quite well with independent voters who hold the balance of power in this country. Now, is he overreaching? Well, we'll see. There are even some Democrats who argue that he's putting too much freight on the truck, that he's trying to do too much too quickly. From his perspective, he's just trying to keep his campaign promises and moving forward aggressively to accomplish what he set before the American people. Of course, the big three, the part of his agenda that is not directly related to the economic crisis or to other, you know, pending bills on Capitol Hill, are health, energy, and education. And those battles are still to come, and they've made it clear that they're going to push very aggressively to actually, if necessary, ram through the health and education parts of their agenda with 51 votes rather than 60.
You write about this. He's pushing a carbon cap and trade system. It's supposed to bring down energy prices and improve the environment. And, you know, he's going to try to push it through with or without Republicans.
No, actually on that one.
Oh, is that the one that he's going to reconcile?
That's the one he has decided that it is just too divisive to try to do that. There's too much opposition within the Democratic Party to do that with 51 votes. You would think that a simple majority wouldn't be controversial, but in the Senate in recent years, it's the tradition has been more 60 votes. So there's just simply not the support for them to ram that through, but they're going to try to get it done anyway, and they have a number of different strategies for getting that accomplished. But the main point here, the larger point that I think is quite similar to the way Franklin Roosevelt handled his first 100 days, is that if you're getting dealt a lot of bad cards, Robin, by fate, by circumstance, by an economy in crisis, the best reaction is to deal your own cards faster, to stay on the offense, to take the initiative. And otherwise, you become buffeted by events and subject to you know, the winds of fate. Now, if you catch a break, like something like this hostage business with the pirates, that helps you keep your winning streak going. But even if you don't, you want to be the captain of your fate. And I think in Barack Obama's defense, he has acted that way since he's become president. He has taken the initiative, seized control, and shown leadership. Even if you think that leadership is taking us in the wrong direction, it's hard to argue with the idea that he has been an activist president.
Just to ask you quickly, though, about the leadership, what about the creeping criticism of some of the people around the president? His economic advisor, Lawrence Summers, it's revealed he made $5 million at a hedge fund just before going to the White House. He and Treasury Secretary Timothy Geithner are seen as partly responsible for the economic mess. And, you know, you talk to people on the street, you know, progressive Democrats, some of the core of Obama's backers, and they're disappointed.
Well, I don't actually think that's necessarily the case. I mean, they're certainly disappointed when they see you know, some of the people who surround him. My reaction to those progressives is that they're not looking closely enough at the facts. This is the most progressive president we've had in this country in more than a generation. He's already accomplished more in terms of public investment and advancement of progressive goals in less than 100 days than Bill Clinton did in 8 years. And that's not an opinion. If you actually look at the amount of money that has been invested in progressive ideas, if you look at a number of these executive orders, I don't think that there's really much of an argument that you could sustain that would suggest that he's less than a progressive president. Has he nationalized the banks, as some progressives want him to do? No. And you could make a good argument. I've been critical of him on some of these banking issues, but The same was said of Franklin Roosevelt. The progressives in 1933 wanted him to nationalize the banks, and he wouldn't do so either.
That's Jonathan Alter from Newsweek and also author of The Defining Moment, FDR's 100 Days and the Triumph of Hope, taking advantage of his being in Boston to get a report card. It sounds like, what's the grade? What's the grade that you would give Barack Obama?
Well, you know, I like to think of myself as a tough grader. I don't like to give flat A's, so I'll give him an A-. And, you know, he's made, as I said, he's made some mistakes. I don't like some of what he's doing in terms of not providing enough accountability for the warrantless wiretaps and some of the other things that have taken place in the Bush administration. But generally speaking, he's been very, very successful.
Jonathan, thanks so much.
Yeah, thanks, Robin.
Okay, still to come today, walking the streets of Raymond Chandler's Los Angeles. But first, the news, here and now.
Your cheating heart will make you weep. You'll cry and cry.
And listen to this. That's Hank Williams Jr. singing his dad's classic. It's among the many gems found in a long-lost treasure trove of live country music recordings, tons of tapes, and we'll give him a listen. That's tomorrow. Stay with us. News is next, here and now.
When tears come down.
I'm Robin Young. It's Here and Now. Quarterly reports are due out this week from some of the banks bailed out with taxpayer money, and the Obama administration is wrapping up its overall examination of banks, putting them to the so-called stress tests. So how's that going? Eric Dash is banking reporter for The New York Times. He joins us from New York. Welcome.
Hi, it's great to be here.
Well, you describe a scene, Eric, of, you know, over 200 federal investigators at 19 of the country's top banks looking at the books, trying to see how much cash there really is, how many losses there really are. But you say that this is a stress test that really no bank can fail because either way they're going to get some money. What do you mean by that?
Right. It's sort of like that second grade spelling test that you can take until you pass. What the regulators are going to do is they're going to tell all the banks that they pass, but some will pass with flying colors, and others will be told you're going to pass only if you can raise new capital because you don't have enough money. If they can't, the government will make money available. Others will be told you need to sell some assets to make it more attractive for private investors to come in.
Well, and this is where the tension arises that we're reading exists now between the banking industry and the Obama administration. Some of these weaker banks that are failing the stress tests don't want to, as the Obama administration is asking them to, sell their toxic assets, because then they'd have to mark them down. They'd have to admit what they're really worth, and they'd show a big loss.
Right. And the other thing that the banks do is that they believe that they have the earnings power, especially in this environment when interest rates are so low and that there are a lot of old competitors have left the market. They believe that they have the earnings power to absorb these losses.
Well, what else is the Obama administration likely to ask banks to do as a result of these tests?
I think you'll see two or three things materialize. The first is that some of the banks will be told you need to raise new capital, and they'll have 6 months to do it. And if they can't, the government will provide capital for them.
And why is that a threat to a bank?
The new capital from the government will come with additional restrictions on executive pay, perhaps management or board changes, and banks, you know, are very reluctant to want that government assistance because the rules have changed so frequently.
Well, and this comes at a time when the bailout money may be running out. The fund, we understand, is down to $134 billion, which sounds like a lot of money, but then you think about all the money that's already been spent. Do we know from the tests so far how much more money banks are going to need?
We really don't, and I think that's one of the things that regulators are trying to balance is, one, how much money are the banks going to really need? And you have all these other parties, like life insurers, lining up for bailouts, too, that they know the fund is running out, and they want to make sure that they have enough money available.
Well, we're going to get some earnings reports from banks this week. Last week, Wells Fargo predicted its first quarter earnings will be twice higher than expected. But we're wondering how much of that good news is the result of the accounting rule change that was approved earlier this month. It's called mark-to-market. It lets banks value their assets not at what they are worth now, but at what they might be worth. For instance, mortgage values have dropped, but banks are allowed to inflate them. Goldman Sachs economists said recently banks were valuing their mortgages at about 91 cents on the dollar much more than investors were willing to pay for them. So given that, how much are these earnings statements worth?
Well, the short answer is that it's really hard to say, and investors are going to make a judgment call as well. But I think it's important to remember that accounting is just not hard and fast rules. It's a series of judgment calls. And the biggest judgment call right now is just how is the economy going to look, you know, 3, 6, 8 months out? And the answer is we don't know. If you believe that the economy is going to get dramatically better, maybe you believe Wells and other banks' estimates. If you believe, as many analysts do, that the economy is going to get dramatically worse, I mean, we still have not seen a full stabilization in the housing market. Consumer spending continues to decline, though at a slower rate than before, and the job losses keep mounting. You know, if you believe that the economy is going to get worse, then maybe things look a little bit bleaker.
This is why it's so hard to sort of gauge really what banks have, because, as you said, no one's really sure what things might be worth in a few months.
It really depends on your view, but I think that regulators and top government officials are concerned that banks are harboring a view that may be more optimistic than most investors think.
Eric Dash, banking reporter for The New York Times. Eric, thanks so much.
Thank you.
Okay, we'll be back in half a minute, here and now. Welcome back. We want to check in now with the town of Postville, Iowa, population about 2,000 and less than it was a year ago. That's when federal officials raided the agriprocessor's kosher meatpacking plant. 389 immigrants were arrested, more than a third of the plant's workforce, and nearly a fifth of the town's population. What has happened to the town since? Stephen Brackett is the pastor of St. Paul Lutheran Church in Postville. Pastor Steve, you've said I can call you that.
Certainly.
What would you say overall the effect on the town has been?
It's been devastating for our town, as you can imagine, to have that number of people forcibly removed from the town at one time, and then the chain reaction that occurred, the effects it's having on our school system. We are a school district that should have merged with someone years ago. But because of agriprocessors being here, we've had many more kids.
Yeah.
And so there's a lot of concern that this school may not survive. Plus, the businesses have been very adversely affected. There are fewer shoppers, so businesses are feeling the effects of both the raid itself and then also the bankruptcy of agriprocessors.
Well, yeah, the plant went into bankruptcy. It's been the subject of an ongoing federal investigation for immigration and child labor law violations, among other things, which prompted a horrified ultra-Orthodox faith to review its kosher meatwork at that plant. But it's had this impact on the town. Did they try to get other workers?
Yes. When the raid occurred, we had hundreds of replacement workers descend upon the town, and some of the initial people who came in came from homeless shelters, and we had many, many problems with crime. And as time went on, they were working more meticulously about who they were bringing in. So groups of individuals were suddenly brought in. We had Somalis from the Twin Cities and the Des Moines area. We had Palauans from the Pacific Island of Palau, many other groups that came in that were more suitable workers.
Well, now, as we said, you know, the plant is really kind of just limping along. Let's talk about the way things were. We know that Hasidic Jews moved to Postville in the 1980s and opened the plant and brought in the first waves of immigrant workers, Mexican Guatemalans. And we read that initially there was some culture clashing, but then when the largely male workers started bringing their families and settling down, things changed. What was it like when things were working well in Postville?
Yeah, at first there were tensions. For some, that transition was too much too fast, and they left the town. I think a lot of it was due to the fact that you had folks who had lived most of their lives in very large cities coming to a very small, rural, northeast Iowa town. And even something so simple as saying hello to someone as you pass them on the street, here that's kind of an expectation. So it took some time for the various groups to try to embrace the diversity that the town of Postville was experiencing.
Well, so Postville was doing pretty well last year, May 12th, when suddenly everybody became aware there were helicopters hovering, which is not normal. And you heard this from your wife, and you drove over and watched the raid. What were your thoughts that day?
I was just impressed by the number of personnel involved in the raid that I could just see on the outside of the plant. There were state police cars, ICE vehicles, county sheriffs. They had blocked off all of the roads leading to agriprocessors.
And then you're seeing people, you know, brought out in handcuffs and loaded into vans and taken away. Your thoughts?
I thought these are members of our community. To see them shackled together 10 at a time in five-point shackles.
Five-point shackles?
That means that their arms are shackled down at their waist so they cannot lift their heads up. Their feet are shackled together. So the message to me there is these are dangerous people. That was the message that I seemed to get, too, from seeing the firearms that were drawn with the people around the perimeter of the plant.
Well, but these were also mothers and fathers. We did stories that day. We understand that kids got text messages while they were at school that the plant was being raided. And that, in fact, there are people now, 40 displaced workers, stuck in a sort of legal limbo in Postville. They're being held to possibly testify. What's happening with them?
The material witnesses were given paperwork allowing them to work. However, not all of them have found work. So the big problem with them is when they were arrested and taken to the Cattle Congress, many of them were pleading, send us back to Guatemala, send us back to Mexico. Then we can support our families. Instead, the majority of them were given a five-month jail sentence for identity theft charges. Then they thought they'd be able to go home after that, and now they're being told, nope, we're keeping you as material witnesses, and they have no idea how long they'll be in the United States.
We read in the Dubuque's Telegraph Herald that it costs about $80,000 a month to take care of these families, and you and other religious leaders are raising money to do just that.
Yeah, immediately after the raid, 45 adults were released, 42 women and 3 men, generally to care for minor children. But they were released with GPS monitoring devices and told they could not work. So St. Bridget's Hispanic Ministry and all of the people who are helping are having to come up with the money to support those individuals and their families.
Well, I imagine, too, these were paid workers with paychecks, and they paid taxes, and your tax revenue must be just in the basement.
Definitely. The housing situation here in town is horrible. A lot of these replacement workers were not given what they were promised. So they were angry. A lot of them just destroyed property as they left. They had way too many people living in each of the places. Plus, the one of the complaints is, well, illegal immigrants come in and they don't pay taxes to the federal government. But the flip side of that is they're in spending money.
What do you think is next for Postville? Is this town going to rebound from this?
I think we will. I think that there are a lot of people who are interested in seeing the town recover. One of the problems we have right now is there are so many unknowns. Agriprocessor still does not have a buyer. If a buyer is not found, then the plant will stop production.
And where do you stand on this? I mean, some would say, look, we have to do something about illegal immigration. But is it, what else could have been done? I mean, where do you think the biggest problem is here?
I want to throw the attention to the United States Congress. They've had the ability to fix the immigration issue. No one has had the courage to take it on. Well, doing immigration raids makes it look like you're doing something about the problem, but it is horribly ineffective and extremely costly. Some of these folks had been here 15 years. Had bought houses, had kids who were U.S. citizens because they were born here. So I think the answer is make people legal.
Even if they came in illegally?
Well, and again, I look at that and I say, why are they able to come here illegally?
Are you saying going forward? Because President Bush tried to do that, and he ran up against his core constituency.
I understand both sides of the argument. But people who say, well, they have to go back to their home country and get in line with everyone else, that is not taking into account the fact that we have not had a process in place to remove them, if that's what the decision of the country is.
Pastor Stephen Brackett, he's with St. Paul Lutheran Church in Postville, Iowa. Pastor Steve, thanks so much for speaking with us.
Thank you very much, Robin.
Okay, and taking a quick look, coming up this week on Here and Now, short story writer Wells Tower, who's getting rave reviews for his latest collection of stories, and 91-year-old composer Leon Kirchner on what he learned from Schoenberg and what he taught Yo-Yo Ma. That's still to come this week, and we're listening to some Kirchner as we also remind you, still ahead, Raymond Chandler lives in 1 minute, Here and Now.
Support for Here and Now comes in part from the Bill and Melinda Gates Foundation, dedicated to the idea that all people deserve the chance to live a healthy, productive life. Information at gatesfoundation.org.
Welcome back to Here and Now. The Big Sleep, The Long Goodbye, classics in American crime fiction written by Raymond Chandler. Chandler created one of the most famous characters in fiction, wisecracking private eye Philip Marlowe.
I ate lunch at a drugstore, bought a pint of bourbon and drove eastward to Central Avenue and north on Central again. The hunch I had was as vague as the heat waves that danced above the sidewalk. Nothing made it my business except curiosity. But strictly speaking, I hadn't any business in a month. Even a no-charge job was a change.
That's actor Elliot Gould giving voice to Philip Marlowe in another Chandler classic, Farewell, My Lovely. Raymond Chandler was born in Chicago, but his fiction captured the fading Art Deco splendor of Los Angeles, his adopted city. So the BBC's Laura Hubbard took to the streets of L.A. to find out how Chandler still resonates there today.
It was spring in Los Angeles. The smell of night-blooming jasmine jockeyed with corruption to fill the thick air. In some ways, not much had changed in the 50 years since Raymond Chandler died. The rich got richer, and the poor just got fleeced. I couldn't help but wonder, did Raymond Chandler and his private eye, Philip Marlowe, still walk the streets of this town? There was only one way to find out. I headed downtown to visit Morgan Neville. His office had wooden blinds and old black telephones, and on the couch, Neville looked as inconspicuous as a tarantula on a slice of angel food. He was making a documentary about Chandler called The Simple Art of Murder. To him, Chandler unmasked the city in a way no one else had.
L.A. was a city that was built by boosters. It was sold in many ways on a myth, and he was the first person to come along and pull back the veneer of that and say, look, there's a lot of other really dark stuff going on underneath.
What was that stuff? Gambling, prostitution, rum running? And murder. Crimes that hummed along like a steam car without brakes.
My name's Marlowe. General Sternwood wanted to see me.
Yes, Mr. Marlowe. Will you come in, please, sir?
By the 30s, L.A. became incredibly corrupt. We had a corrupt mayor who was eventually kicked out. We had a corrupt police department and scandals every day in the papers. And this is what Chandler was reading as he started his career in mystery writing.
Didn't sound that far off from the city I knew. The one Robert Towne wrote about in Chinatown, and Curtis Hanson in L.A. Confidential. They weren't home when I called, but I knew another filmmaker, Carl Franklin, could help me. He drew on Chandler's vision of Los Angeles for his noir-inspired films, Devil in a Blue Dress and One False Move. The streets were dark with something more than night as I climbed into the hills over Hollywood and paid him a visit.
L.A., it's kind of a perfect arena for noir in some ways, as opposed to, say, New York. Because New York, you know, in terms of the crime that's committed there, it seems like that a lot of it is explained by social conditions. People live very, very cramped and close to each other, and so that would probably naturally spur a lot more interaction, and which would mean some of that interaction is going to be crime, and, you know, there's the fight for space and all of that. Out here, you know, with this sunshine and everything's kind of spread out, it's almost like the Garden of Eden, where people kind of choose to do wrong, you know, where it's almost like, you know, yeah, here we are, you know, in this great place, but after all, we are what we are. Choose and eat that apple, yeah, because it's on the tree, you know, among the oranges and all those other great pieces of fruit that are out here, you know, but I'm into that apple, you know.
I roll back down into the heart of the city, confident that the Los Angeles Chandler described still existed, stronger than before. But while Chandler enjoyed exposing the city, the writer himself remained as enigmatic as a chauffeur's killer in The Big Sleep. To find out more about the author and his most famous character, I met Chandler's young biographer, Tom Williams, at a cafe on the corner of Sepulveda and Santa Monica Boulevards. The kid's face had as much expression as a cut of round steak and was about the same color, but Williams knew his subject.
He was an alcoholic too, of course, very, very famously. Drank a lot in the 20s and got sacked from his job in the oil industry in the 30s because of his alcoholism. And he picked up writing because that was one of his ways of getting off the alcohol. It was a way of isolating himself from the world. So he locked himself away in his house with his wife and wrote and didn't drink.
Philip Marlowe was Chandler's most famous character, a cynical detective who acted from his own moral code. Williams tells me Chandler was fascinated by Arthurian legends and that Marlowe was named after Malory, the author of those most chivalric of romances.
You know, he is the knight who reasserts order amongst chaos, but he's also a very appealing knight. He's a nice guy. I mean, he does some bad things, and he hates himself for it, but he is a good person in a sort of bad world. I think down these mean streets, a good man must walk, and that man is Marlowe. That's Chandler from his essay on detective fiction.
Humphrey Bogart, Dick Powell, and Robert Montgomery played Marlowe in the 1940s, but it was Elliot Gould's reinterpretation of Marlowe and Robert Altman's The Long Goodbye that recast the detective for the Vietnam War generation. I hoofed it a few miles to Gould's apartment, not sure he'd want to see me, less sure he'd want to talk, but he liked Marlowe. In fact, it felt like he still was Marlowe, 35 years later.
His world doesn't change. He lives in a world that has values that are in relation to what our ideals and dreams are. And it's a man of ethical and moral backbone. And that will never change with this character. And therefore, it can be extremely humorous to see the world through his eyes.
According to Gould, Marlowe hasn't seen his last day. Far from it. Clive Owen is slated to play the detective in a period film, and Gould hopes to play Marlowe 30 years on in a film to be directed by Alan Rudolph. Gould seemed honest and humble, but I wasn't convinced there was still a place for that kind of character in Los Angeles today, a private eye with a code. To find out, I headed east one last time, to an apartment hidden behind Bougainvillea, about 6 blocks from where Chandler once lived. The woman's name was Judith Freeman. The exotic brunette didn't move more than one eyelash. Her book, The Long Embrace, imagines the life Raymond Chandler had with his wife, Sissy, who was 18 years his senior. I asked her if the spirit of Philip Marlowe still lives in Los Angeles today.
He is such a moral personality in a time when many of us are just so appalled at how horribly corrupt our institutions have become. We realize that in the end, it's the individual conscience that will make a difference in a society. And I think that half poetical emotion at the heart of Marlowe and of every Chandler novel is what really makes those books last.
That report came to us from the BBC's Laura Huber. Here and Now is a production of WBUR Boston in association with the BBC World Service and PRI. I'm Robin Young. Please join us again here and now.
Funding for Here and Now comes from the MathWorks, creators of MATLAB and Simulink technical computing software, on the web at mathworks.com.
PRI, Public Radio International.